Audi.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Thank you so much to all of you for your continued support, and also welcome to any new listeners. This week we've hit the number one spot on iTunes UK places and travel for the first time. We've been at number two plenty of times, but I'm so glad to have made the number one slot. We've had recent mentions on the Evening Standard, on BBC Radio 5 Live, on Talk Radio, and in the Great British Podcasts newsletter, and even on Sky News, so I'm sure that's helped, and thank you so much. For any new listeners to the podcast, I aim to speak to fascinating folk about their travels every week, and there are 68 episodes to catch up on with many famous names, adventurers, explorers, authors, journalists, politicians, comedians, philanthropists, and much more. So have a listen to the back catalogue if you wish. Today's guest is coming up right now, and if you're into music or festivals, you're in for a complete treat. Festival promoter, DJ and record label boss Rob DeBank started in music as a journalist reviewing the biggest bands, super clubs and DJs all over the UK. He's had his own show on BBC Radio 1 and is the co-founder of two of the UK's biggest festivals, Bestival and Camp Bestival. He's a massive fan of travel, whether touring Europe in a yellow camper van called Stella, taking his four kids on sabbatical to Bali, or DJing at some of the best parties all over the world. With his own very successful podcast too, the A to Z of Festivals, it's Rob DeBank.
I know you've travelled a huge amount through your work, but also for fun. But I wanted to take you back to your first childhood holidays, because they sound very much like mine, that you went off in the 70s and 80s in a camper van, in a Bedford van, I think you said, which we had as well, to the south of France. Is that a good place to start?
Crikey, that's quite terrifying that you know that much about my life.
Oh, I've done no research.
Yes, no, that is true. Yeah, I mean, I was born in 73, so by the late 70s, we were sort of going on family holidays with my brother and sister in my dad's beaten-up blue Bedford camper van, which, you know, if people saw it now, or anyone under the age of 30 saw it now, they'd be like, "That, you can't drive that to the south of France, it's impossible." And, you know, you just don't see old things like that on the road now. But then, yeah, it was a vehicle of choice. It was luxury. So, yeah, I slept across the front seats on a wooden plank, which sounds a bit medieval. But, yeah, there were two kind of roll-out bunks for my brother and sister. And then my mum and dad were on the sort of double bed bit sofa. And then, yeah, so I slept with the kind of gear stick not between my legs, that sounds a bit wrong, but the gear stick was there and I was lying on this plank across the front seat. But yeah, we toured up and down France in that. We ended up at the Berlin Wall. I remember probably a little bit later when I was 14, 15, I just found a photo of me walking through the Berlin Wall, which was being in the midst of being knocked down, literally after that had just fallen. So my dad's still got that van now. So
has he still got the same van?
He has. My dad is a bit of a hoarder, I'm sure he won't mind me saying.
Does it still go?
Yeah, he still drives around in it.
So what year is the van?
Well, pre-76, I don't know.
That's amazing. I can't believe it's still roadworthy. It's probably not roadworthy, is it?
Oh, no, totally. My dad, you know, he's the sort of person that will buy something 100 years ago and keep it running. So, yeah, it'll definitely be roadworthy.
Did that foster your love of camping, do you think? If you do
maybe
have a love of camping,
love-hate of camping. My dad had this version of things that he... we'd drive into a campsite in France late at night so that the guardian guy, you know, the sort of campsite warden had gone home, and then in the morning he'd make me lift up the barrier and sneak out before he had to pay. So it's like, yeah, we'd go around campsites doing that to save money. But yeah, I mean, it definitely made me not scared of sleeping, you know, in the great outdoors. Yeah, they sometimes used to put up a kind of awning or a tent next door, and some of the kids would sleep in that. Yeah, I love camping. I do absolutely love camping, and any opportunity I'm out there with the kids.
You made that your life and work in a way with festivals, but do you not sort of like, now that you know you're sort of in the successful realm of festivals, do you still like camp in a van or a tent, or do you have like a luxury teepee or something like that?
Yeah, it sort of differs really each year. Sometimes we've got a bell tent, our own bell tent that we sleep in with the kids. I've got my 1970s VW trademark stereotypical hippie van, bright yellow, called Stella, and you know, everyone loves that. We do sometimes sleep in an RV, you know, like in a big sort of motorhome. You know, we had another baby a couple of years ago, so Josie literally turned up on site 6 days after he'd been born, having had an emergency cesarean like 6 days previous, and we were there with the baby. So that year we slept in a slightly bigger RV. Yeah, so sometimes, you know, you're there with the fake fireplace and the TV. Sometimes we're just in a bell tent or the camper.
I want to talk to you a lot about family travel, but just you saying that makes me, I mean, I was always a festival person. In fact, you and I have spoken before when I was working for the Essential Festival. Do you remember the Essential Festival?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Remember it well, yeah.
Years
in Brighton,
ago?
Yeah.
In Brighton, that's right. My first few jobs were in festivals for Essential and then for Harvey Goldsmith. We won't talk about that. It was the Eclipse Festival, do you remember?
It all went terribly wrong. I didn't go, but I did. What was there, no eclipse? Or?
Oh, then no, the eclipse kind of happened. It was very cloudy, actually, and I remember being on a hill. You know, we'd worked for a year on this festival, and we had several rival festivals. There was the Lizard down at the Lizard Peninsula, and everything was building up to this one eclipse moment, which I think it was about midday on the Sunday or something like that, and it was completely cloudy. And I remember, like, being stuck between, I was doing the press for the event and, like, trying to organise all these acts and media and everything. It had been quite complicated. By that point, they'd stopped paying us, but I just thought, well, I'm going to do this anyway, it's going to be a great experience. And I do remember having this incredible moment when the sky, there was no like actual eclipse, but it went just very cloudy.
Oh no. Yeah.
It went even more cloudy. Yeah, it went from a light grey to a dark grey. Yeah. And everything did go silent. And
Welcome.
I think after that, it wasn't like the best festival experience.
No.
But it was fun, you know, in retrospect. I wanted to talk to you about family travel, but before that, I want to talk to you about what happened in the 90s, because you went to university in Goldsmiths, didn't you? New Cross in London, which was, you know, it's a really trendy place now. Everyone goes,
so I've heard.
Yeah, because I live nearby there, like, okay. Live in Greenwich, and they go, and people go, oh, you live near New Cross, that's great. I was like, really, is it? It was a different place back in the early 90s. It was a different place 5 years ago, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, New Cross, I was like a 18-year-old, very kind of middle-class white kid, dropped into the middle of New Cross. My sister drove me up there in a mini metro because my mum and dad were away. I remember, you know, literally just driving through the streets of New Cross going, wow, this is so different to the little pastoral village upbringing that I had. And I'd been to London, obviously, loads of times, but yeah, it was a total baptism of fire in a very good way, and in a sort of slightly worrying way. I was mugged numerous times by a drug dealer who ended up befriending me, ended up taking me to the, well, forcing me to go to the cash pot and then take him to the Wimpy to buy him a burger. It was all very, very odd and a bit scary, driving around in unmarked police cars, you know, being told to point out this guy who I wouldn't shop in because I was too scared about having my legs chopped off or something. So it was, and I had to get up in front of the whole halls of residence and be sort of shown as an example of someone who'd been mugged, and can everyone please keep an eye out for... And so, yeah, I mean, New Cross was racy, but actually, you know, those are the areas of London that I kind of miss and love. You know, Brixton, Old Street, when Josie opened her bar there, she was like one of the youngest licensed bar holders just when the 333 and the whole Shoreditch scene were kicking off. You know, we lived in Brixton when that was a bit rough around the edges. Yeah, and everything gets gentrified, which is cool, but you know, I had some amazing experiences in those places, Camberwell, South London.
Did you, looking back, like it was obvious, maybe I sort of felt it at the time, that you were part of like a really incredible music scene? Did you feel it? Did you feel the sort of zeitgeist happening as it happened?
Not really. I mean, yeah, I was incredibly, you know, part of the reason I actually wanted to go to Manchester because it was just after Madchester, well, sort of during Madchester, so Happy Mondays, Stone Roses, and these were all my idols, you know, Ian Brown and Bears and Sean Ryder, and, you know, I had all the flares and the whole Manchester outfit. I wanted to go to Manchester, didn't get in there, went to London instead, and it was just when the whole rave culture, jungle, hadn't become drum and bass yet. Trance, you know, which is a dirty word now, but the whole trance scene was really exciting and really actually amazing music at that time. And the whole chill out thing as well, which I became sort of known for, that was really exploding as well, which became a bit of a dirty word again, but at the time was really exciting. So yeah, I mean, me and Josie, we met in the first term of the first year, and we would just spend the whole rest of the time going to Spiral Tribe raves, going to Glastonbury, going to Gumbo raves in Oxfordshire, driving around in my little 2CV, just living the life. But it felt like something that was going to keep going, and it has kind of kept going. You know, club culture's maybe gone overground and mainstream, but it's also gone underground, and it's still there. It's maybe, but I hate people who sort of look back and go, oh, it's not as good as it used to be. You know, that might be true in certain ways, but I think in a way it's better as well.
I think everyone was saying that at the time, though. Everyone always looks back. I remember being in the 90s and people would say, oh, you should have, like in Brighton, for example, oh, you should have been here in the 80s, you know, yeah. And probably in the 80s someone was saying, you should have been here in the 60s yeah, 70s, and 70s. Yeah, it has that sort of rose-coloured sheen when you look back.
Yeah.
I know you're good friends with, well, you know, Emily Eavis quite well now, and you've had her on your podcast. Can you tell me whether you were bunking into Glastonbury then or not? I bet you were.
I was, and I've met and interviewed Michael many times and Emily, and apologised to them on numerous occasions publicly and in private. I mean, you know, it's no surprise or news that lots of people did. Yeah, I mean, I remember giving, you know, Krusty's cans of cider to go, be allowed to burrow under their hole, you know, that they dug a little tunnel before the security found them. I remember vaulting over a fence as a gang of guys on horses came galloping at us at full speed, absolutely terrifying. I'm scared of horses anyway, and it's sort of four or five horses coming up this hill, and we're like, come on, quick, get over, and sort of pushing Josie over and then jumping over myself. And
who's the cavalry? Are
they, well, they had a sort of
security,
yeah,
cavalry.
Yeah, I mean,
they weren't
in the sort of yellow jackets and stuff, but
swords,
they were,
and things, yeah.
Yeah, it was like that. It was like something quite medieval, but yeah, so we did quite a few years of that, and then luckily I obviously started DJing there. And well, I just dug out a flyer yesterday. We were doing the Sunday Best, hosting the Radio 1 stage there with people like Fatboy Slim and Basement Jack. So, you know, that was the kind of kernel, the sort of seed of where Best of All came from, because we suddenly were allowed on the Radio 1 stage, and we would take it over for the whole day. We'd do the whole fancy dress thing, the whole dressing up, choose our own DJs, and that was like, oh my God, this is like the best thing ever. We've got our own stage at Glastonbury, and, you know, that was over 20 years ago. And it, yeah, it definitely fed into the whole Best of All story.
So you started to travel. I mean, I think that festivals are part of travel, you know, particularly like going to, you know, Glastonbury, and ones that you do generally have to travel for them. I guess this all depends on when you live, but I really think that festivals are part of travel. But in terms of travel at the time, so you start DJing, where was it? Was it sort of naturally Ibiza, you know, those sort of places?
Yeah, all the cliched stereotypical hotspots, Ibiza, Miami, yeah, I mean all over the place, but yeah, mostly yeah, the States. I mean, I was a music journalist first of all, so alongside my DJing, which was I wasn't known as a DJ then, but I was sort of known as a music journalist, and I was a clubs editor for a magazine. So actually,
that was where I used to speak to you at
Music,
at Essential. What was the magazine?
Music magazine.
Yes,
yeah.
That's when I remember speaking to you. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not glamorous travelling, but actually, and I'm really grateful for this. The first lot of travelling I was doing was mostly in the UK, and I was being sent out each weekend to go and cover these insane clubs, which were just kind of, you know, it's the era of the super clubs, so Gatecrasher, Cream, God's Kitchen, all these clubs that were like, you know, 5,000-6,000 kids turning up in insane outfits every week, absolutely devoted to the DJs. You know, the DJ was God. Paul Oakenfold, Sasha, you know, Seb Fontaine, all these guys paid tens of thousands of pounds, you know, every night to do this thing. And so I, you know, I was kid from the south of England in a village. I'd gone to London, which is exciting as it was, and then suddenly I was in Birmingham, Newcastle, Sheffield, Glasgow, Dublin, you know, and all these cities that actually I realise a lot of my mates, even now in their mid-40s, haven't even been to. And, you know, to a lot of Southerners, the North is still a bit of a mystery, and maybe vice versa. So I'm really grateful for that, because probably for 4 or 5 years I was literally whizzing around the UK, travelling, exploring that. And, you know, you have to do that to understand how the UK works. And even now with things like Brexit, it all sort of feeds back into that. And I don't mean that in any kind of pejorative way to whether you're a Northerner or a Southerner. But you don't understand how the cultures are so different. You know, Saturday night in Newcastle, everyone is dressed to the nines. Everyone is like really making an effort, and then you get down to London, everyone's like, oh, Saturday night, yeah, whatever, it's the new Monday. So it's a different way of looking at stuff. And then alongside that, I was being sent off on really quite exciting trips to go and interview Basement Jacks in New York, or Todd Terry in Miami, or Armin van Helden in Ibiza, or, you know, and getting paid to do it. So this was like the absolute dream, until I did one summer where my editor sent me to Ibiza. I'm not very good at saying no, so let's just say that I went off the rails in quite a big way, and it was a kind of, you know, it was that sort of paradise turning into hell type thing. And I think you've got to be careful in Ibiza, because it is, you know, there's a lot of temptation out there, so you've got to kind of just stay on the straight and narrow. So yeah, I mean,
I just read Matt Haig's Reasons to Stay Alive. Have you read that? I don't know if you know that.
Yeah.
That really fucked him up, you know, a whole season in Ibiza, and then after that he was just, you know, a bit fucked up for about 10 years really.
Yeah, I don't think it lasted 10 years with me, but it was definitely a good couple of years. And I remember coming back to London after a summer out there, and I was just so away with the fairies. I sort of was like, didn't know what real life was really, so just the whole experience was it taught me a lesson. And, you know, I think it also taught me about travel and about being somewhere else. You know, you've got to keep with it, because it can easily kind of get out of hand, or you know you can find yourself in the most beautiful places in the world and not actually maybe be enjoying it like you should be. So I don't mean that in a negative way, because I'm always glass half full, but I think, you know, you see that with a lot of DJs actually, and mental health issues in the dance music industry, particularly DJs who are perceived to live this incredible, amazing lifestyle. And you know, you saw it with Avicii, who sadly, you know, killed himself because he just couldn't deal with being sent off on another mad mission around the world to all these incredible places, and you end up sitting in hotel rooms on your own, kind of staring at the ceiling, waiting for your next big gig, and then you've got this massive slump afterwards. And that was not my story, luckily, but you know, you sort of see that. And so, yeah, I think with travel, you've got to kind of respect it.
Also, you're out all night as well, aren't you? You're out all night partying, whatever that entails, that is not good for you. But even just being up all night, your circadian rhythms are absolutely screwed up, and you must have all these feelings of euphoria like you do when you're clubbing. You know, you don't even have to be a DJ, and then, you know, obviously you get the come down from that. So describe to me, what do you think has been your most wild night out?
Probably can't really remember them, but yeah, I mean, a lot in Ibiza, a lot in Miami, that, you know, all-nighters, waking up on a beach in Ibiza with my tongue sort of glued to the sand, having lost all my friends and not actually knowing where I was, and having to walk back barefoot to a villa or something like that. I mean, yeah, you know, I'm in a very happy place right now with four amazing kids and Josie, who I've been with since I was 18. And so I don't want to paint some kind of hedonistic mad lifestyle. There was a period of hedonism and mad antics. Luckily, that coincided with an amazing lot of work and sort of travel. And I'm a real workaholic. I mean, you know, at the base of everything I do, I've not sort of bummed around the world just doing nothing. It's always been, you know, it's nearly always been a lot of it's on a work related stuff, unless it's a holiday.
Which is what is the best thing in life, is to actually be able to make your passion your work. Do you feel lucky to have done that?
Oh God, so lucky. I mean, it was as a result of hard work. I wasn't handed this. I did 5 or 6 years work experience, pretty much unpaid, on the magazine on and off before I got a really, you know, great job there and moved up, you know, moved my way up to assistant editor and stuff like that. So, it, you know, I worked really hard to get there, but there's been a lot of happy accidents in my life as well, and I'm sort of conscious of that, of you know, being in the right place at the right time. You know, the early work that I did interviewing people like Fatboy Slim, Basement Jack, Scribble Armada, that sort of paid off when we started Bestival, and I needed some headliners, and I knew these guys, so their agents were a bit nicer to me because I was still pretty much Billy Nobody, and I needed to pull in some favours. So yeah, you know, I think it's, yeah, happy accidents, but also, you know, hard work.
I've been round to Norm's house to interview him as well. That was in his stage when he was still, like, reasonably hedonistic. I'd stopped by then, but he was still, like, partying, and he's like, so what do you do for fun? I was like, I don't know, it's all right. But you, I'm in awe of you. You mentioned the kids, and I've got two boys, 6 and 4, and you've got 4 boys,
yeah.
And you travel a lot with them. Well, from what I can see online, you've been to Bali for 3 months, you've been around Europe in a camper van, and travelling does change. I mean, I haven't stopped travelling, but it really does change when you have kids. How has it changed for you?
Yeah, I mean, we do try and travel with them, and we do try and take them to out of the way places that maybe, you know, are a bit challenging. You know, at the same time, we're sensible, we're not sort of dragging sort of 6-month-old babies to Cambodia or whatever. It's sort of, you know, we're trying to make sure it's kind of a safe trip, but also exciting. And, you know, sometimes we just go camping on the Isle of Wight. Sometimes, you know, we were lucky enough to go on a sort of 6 or 7 week sabbatical to Bali and Indonesia, and yeah, I mean, it was incredible, you know, eye-opening stuff for us as well as the kids. So, you know, that was pure kind of holiday that time. But most of the time, yeah, see, you know, we've been to places like the Maldives, but you know, that's when I'll often get a DJ gig, and then we can go there, you know, as a family. So just discussing now about taking them back to India, they absolutely love India. We've done kind of Rajasthan with them, and we've done Goa, and Josie's planning this mad trip from the Himalayas down to Goa and Kerala. So
what sort of mode of vehicle?
Well, not self-powered, so yeah, it'd be train, maybe planes if we needed to skip bits. But yeah, I mean, you know, we love doing the trains, but again, you know, India is not, you know, not quite got the health and safety checks of
India is hard work, isn't it? It really is hard work, and I've only ever been there pre-kids, so I cannot imagine now taking my 4-year-old and 6-year-old, you know, even walking down the road, you know, when you've got bikes and vehicles and cows and holes and people dragging you off to a corner and trying to stick something in your ear or sell you something.
I'm a little bit, I have to, they're great,
perforate your eardrum. But I'm nervous of it, actually. Even though I thought I'm this great traveller, I'm actually nervous of taking the kids
there. There's a Soho house in Mumbai now, so...
Oh, well, there you go.
I mean, you know, seriously, though, you know, India, even in the last 10 years, you know, has become so much... you know, so much different, and I know there's still obviously a huge amount of poverty there, and it's by no means changed for the majority of people, but as a traveller, then there's a very safe way and enjoyable way that you can do it without, we haven't got millions of pounds to go first class or anything like that, and you can still do those experiences. And actually, you know, you don't really want to be in a sort of air-conditioned car cruising through India. You want to be in a bus or on a train, or maybe not a rickshaw, but you know, you want to be sort of out there. And yeah, taking the kids around Delhi in a bicycle rickshaw, you know, is only an hour long, but you know, that's an experience that they'll probably never forget. It's it's those kind of places.
I remember what I was going to say now, and it was actually about Zoe Ball and Norman Cook, and I remember it was Zoe, I don't know whether she actually said it and I heard it, or she said it somewhere and I read it or something, but anyway, I remember her saying that she was backstage, she was heavily pregnant, was Widdy, and she was backstage in the dance area of Glastonbury, and I've stayed backstage in the dance area of Glastonbury.
Yeah, never stops.
It's hardcore.
yeah.
And I remember her saying that she was really heavily pregnant, and it was at that moment that she thought, oh, hang on, you know, maybe I've got to change something a little bit. And it sounds like, you know, you guys, like all of us, have grown up, and you know, your parents and everything. How is it managing the kids and the festivals and everything?
I mean, that's great. You know, we obviously kind of invented Camp Bestival for our kids. So, you know, Bestival was and is a hedonistic party, 24-hour non-stop party rave up. Camp Bestival, you know, we kind of invented it for our kids with our partners, and you know, that's the primary goal of that show, is to run a festival, have a brilliant festival for everyone else, but also to enjoy it ourselves. And that's the key thing, is that we can have a few hours off here and there, and we can kind of go around it. And so everything, you know, even the design of the site and everything is based on us selfishly being able to leave our campsite, get around it in an hour, and get back and still hang out with the kids. And it's great.
It sounds amazing. I've never been, and I tell you why I've never been, because I'm always away, and I'd really, really love to take the kids. And half of me thinks every summer, I actually think I will postpone my holiday to go to this festival. And then I think, no, because we've got a place in Spain, I think I'm going for the whole 6 weeks.
You do too much travelling, that's your problem.
I know, it is, yeah. I want to go so much that I've even sort of flying back for it, but, you know, once there's four of you and flights and everything. And I wouldn't want to come without them anyway.
No, sure. I mean, you know, we do it at the beginning of the summer holidays to try and, well, I suppose, capitalise on people who've just finished school and they want to have an escape, and you know, not in a kind of cynical way, but we want that to be the first thing that everyone does. They're like, right, come on, school's over, get the school uniforms in the cupboard, let's, you know, jump in the car or the van or whatever, get down to Camp Bestival, forget about technology for a while if you can, you know, forget about you know, your daily lives, and, you know, get out in a field. And that's what, you know, yeah, we've got some great headliners or whatever, but actually it's about reconnecting with your family, it's about travelling, it's about camping, it's about being outdoors, it's about learning stuff that you might not learn anywhere else. So it's yeah, I think we're having a lot of fun with Camp Bestival at the moment. It's almost like we're having a renaissance with it, and it's you know, it's just such a nice way to start the summer holidays. And we get a lot of parents emailing us and calling us afterwards saying, oh, thanks very much, now you've spoiled the rest of our summer holidays, because nothing can live up to that. So without blowing our own trumpets, then a lot of people sort of see it as the pinnacle of their summer holidays.
Oh yeah, no, it does sound absolutely perfect. The closest I've got to it with kids is there's in a new festival that's been running for about 4 or 5 years now, and I worry for its sort of safety, because every year, you know, we don't know whether it's coming on or not, but it's called On Blackheath. I don't know if you've been.
Yeah.
It's really good, and it's on Blackheath in southeast London, and it's just a day festival, but it's so set up for the kids. You know, it's got CBeebies entertainers, a bit like you guys from what I read. And it's brilliant. We go with the kids in the daytime and then come back later, kids, babysitters, and, you know, you've got all boxes ticked, basically, which it sounds
like. That's great
like
for you, because it's very, very local, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and some really good acts on there as well, actually.
Yeah.
Craig Charles is always my favourite, because I like a little dance
he
in the tent.
He is the DJ of DJs.
Okay, I'm just going to ask you a quick fellow around, and I'm going to make it up because I haven't planned it, but just to get a few more travel stories.
Yeah.
The best party I've ever been to abroad.
The best party I've ever been to? Crikey. Probably one of the Daft Punk parties in Miami. I mean, yeah, I was lucky enough to be, you know, a music journalist in the 90s and the early 2000s, and so yeah, I remember pool parties with Daft Punk. I accidentally pushed someone in the pool and they broke their leg, which was a slightly unfortunate. And but that, yeah, those sort of parties, you know, you go through the night, see the dawn rising over the Floridian Sea, and yeah, Miami always good for that.
Somewhere you've been, doesn't a country or a city or a night out when you thought, oh, I really shouldn't have come here?
Not necessarily in a bad way, but in a slightly scary way, probably Cuba. Me and Josie went there a long time ago, actually, and I really want to go back before it's totally decimated by whoever decimates it. But not pointing the fingers at President Trump. But yeah, we ended up going to Santiago to Cuba, which is, you know, it's still a big city, slightly off the beaten track, and just finding ourselves down this mad sort of alleyway going to a party and drinking this green liquid that we had absolutely no idea what it was. It was fine and it had a good effect, but yeah, I think we felt a bit threatened there. And then actually makes me think of Rio as well, where we were on our way to Rio and we were in Sao Paulo, yeah, which is notoriously, you know, can be a bit touch and go if you walk down the wrong road. And we did walk down the wrong road and suddenly found ourselves in this alley with all these shady men. And that was the closest I've felt to feeling properly scared. I'm sure nothing was going to happen, but yeah,
you went to university in New Cross. You can do
that. Yeah, but I'm still a total wimp. couldn't deal with a fight.
The happiest place you've been? The happiest you've ever felt somewhere abroad?
I mean, honestly, numerous holidays, probably, you know, Highlands of Scotland, we love. We got married on a beach in Scotland, Sanna Sands, you know, so we go up there with the kids, and often it's pouring with rain, but we're sort of like beachcombing and finding our tea in the rivers and lochs and stuff, and mussels and lobsters and stuff like that. But Puglia in Italy, there's a hotel called Borgo Ignazia. It kind of looks like you're in a Wild West sort of spaghetti western set. It's all like amazing sort of town squares within this hotel, and you know, it feels like you're in a in a sort of film set. So yeah, Borgo Ignazia. I like places that are very cut off, because then there's less chance of having to go and do something. And you know, because I'm really bad at sitting still. As it drives Josie and the kids around the bend, I'm not very good on a sun lounger, just kind of relaxing. So if there's things nearby where I feel I should be seeing them, or I'm missing out, then I'll be hiring a car or renting a bike, or come on kids, let's go and see this medieval castle up there. And it's like, well no dad, can't we just like play on the beach? And I'm gradually getting into that frame of mind of actually less is more, and maybe, you know, sitting on a beach and just reconnecting with your family is fine. You don't have to go and explore every single nook and cranny of every area. So yeah, Puglia is, you know, it's quite remote, I think it's fair to say, in Italy, and you know, it's quite untouched, but there's not all that many things to do once you get there. So yeah, that was where I was very, very relaxed and happy.
And one place you'd really recommend?
I mean, one place where we've been lucky enough to go there twice, I think, now, and it's gotten so expensive the last few years, but Rayavadi in Thailand. I mean, Krabi can be a bit touristy, parts of it, but it's like next to one of the most, you know, it's always voted one of the most beautiful beaches in the world. It's got this massive cave at the end, which the kids find hilarious because it's full of phallic symbols. So
it's the fertility cave.
Yeah, fertility cave. So I think they call it the Willy Cave, which I'm hopefully allowed to say. But yeah, so you know, huge kind of phalluses, about 6 foot tall, and then tiny little ones and stuff, and everything in between, all set on this incredible beach. And the great thing about Thailand is there's no private beaches allowed, so everything's a public beach. But for the first few hours of the day, it's really lovely, and then everyone arrives on the long tail boats, or these little supermarkets. Well, these boats turn into like floating restaurants and supermarkets, and yeah, it's just incredible sort of atmosphere. And then everyone goes at about 5 o'clock, and you've got the beach to yourself for another few hours. And there's this sort of big caves in the middle of this mountain that's right on the edge of the hotel, and you can go sort of caving in there, fishing, snorkeling. Yeah, it's absolute paradise and beautiful for kids. So yeah, Rayavadi and Krabi.
I've been there and stayed at exactly the same hotel in Raleigh Beach, the Rayavadi, and yeah, it's amazing. Although I got attacked by monkeys, which was quite interesting.
Yeah, I think there are some lively monkeys there.
Brilliant. I would like to ask you my last question, and I don't know how you're going to choose this, because my last question is always about music, because I'm a massive music fan. I'm a failed festival organiser. Well, I never pursued it after the first sort of three or four jobs. I wish I had. I accidentally fell into corporate events. But anyway, if you had to choose one song that reminds you of a special or memorable time and place of travel, what would that one song be?
Crikey, that is a good question. Probably, going back to Scotland when me and Josie got married, and we it was September, and it had been pouring with rain for about 2 days, and then about half an hour before we got married on this beach called Sanna Sands, really, really right at the most westernmost point of the British Isles or something, and about half an hour before we got married, the sun came out, and I drove Josie to the beach. Did I drive Josie? No, I drove all my mates to the beach in my old camper van. Josie got driven there by my dad, and we were playing a Lou Reed album. Satellite of Love came on, I think, and it was just, you know, it was a bit cheesy, but I was going to get married. The sun came out, and we had a beautiful day with a piper playing on the top of the hill and all our friends on the sand. And so Lou Reed, Satellite of Love.
That's a really lovely imagery. Thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rob. I love that image of you heading off to marry Josie in the camper van with all your mates listening to Lou Reed. We'll be back next week with another brilliant guest. Thank you so much for listening to the Big Travel Podcast.